How do we rethink the stories of our own history? From SDPB, today is Thursday, September 25th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, a walk through history from three different perspectives. First, we stroll with a Sioux Falls woman who became captivated by historical markers during the pandemic. Her dance with the skeletons in our collective closet became a podcast, Local Lou. Then a bus tour that takes travelers through Lakota landscapes and asks all of us to rethink how history is presented. Dr. Craig Howe joins us for a conversation about how we reconsider the stories we thought we understood. Then historic buildings across the state are at a tipping point. Bernie Hunhoff considers what's worth saving. That's coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from the SDPB Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Take a walk through the falling leaves almost anywhere in South Dakota, and history practically crunches beneath your feet. In our neighborhood, for example, here near the SDPB Sioux Falls studios, you can find historical markers describing a presidential visit, the town's reputation as a haven for divorce, and a true crime story, complete with a deathbed confession. These markers say something about the history we choose to preserve, about the stories we choose to tell, and perhaps most curiously, how we tell those stories. That is exactly what the Local Lou podcast explores. The host finds, reads, and researches markers around Sioux Falls and other areas of the state. Lori Kent, also known as Local Lou, gave us a walking tour of historical markers near the Old Courthouse Museum in downtown Sioux Falls.
They're not super noticeable.
These ones are actually kind of hidden. I would agree with you there. And honestly, there's a lot of historical markers in Sioux Falls that you might just walk right by if you don't know that they're there. But these ones are in, you know, the shadow of the old courthouse, and they have some really cool history on them. I never understood, like, how many presidents came to Sioux Falls. Okay. I feel like that's a really interesting thing to me for whatever reason. Like, our first president to come to Sioux Falls would be McKinley, and then we had Teddy Roosevelt come when he was running, and then we have President Woodrow Wilson. And so he comes here when he is campaigning for the League of Nations and the Treaty of Versailles, and he actually comes right to this area. He comes in on the Omaha Railroad, and it's so cool that we are a stop for a president of the United States. Like, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, we're on that list. And I think the fact that this is right next to the divorce capital historical marker, they really are connected. Now, I actually got to see you interview April White for the Divorce Colony book, and her book is so amazing and eye-opening, but I think the sentence that stands out to me the most from the whole entire book is that John Jacob Astor III said that Sioux Falls is a thriving and interesting place. And she quotes that in her divorce trial. Maggie Astor deserves quotes that. And I think that's a super important thing for us to understand. And that's why the Divorce Capital Historical Marker is one of my favorites. You know, Sioux Falls, we could have not become a city.
Right.
There's a lot of make and break happening. The railroad coming through didn't necessarily mean that you're going to be successful. And I feel like without the divorce capital essence, we may not have survived, because that's where we get all of these lawyers being in town. We have well-to-do people coming in. We have this flow of money to get our city going, which was so vital. Like, a railroad isn't enough. There's plenty of cities in South Dakota that didn't make it that had a railroad stop there. And so the divorce capital. It gets our courthouse built. It gets all of these lawyers here. It gets tons and tons of people that would have never come to Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Like, we weren't on their map, but then we were. And so I love that. And everybody should read April White's book.
Let's go back a little bit and tell me about when you first started.
I'd lived next to a historical marker, and I kind of wondered, how that marker got made, why it got made, how accurate the history on it was, and how they decided that. So it was a historical marker about Jesse James and his brother coming through Sioux Falls after the Northfield Bank robbery. And I'm like, how can we prove that? So I looked it up, and there are newspaper articles of a stagecoach driver who had two men stop and ask him for directions. And when he described what the two men looked like, people were like, I think that's the James brothers who are fleeing this bank robbery. I mean, there was like a manhunt going on. And the stagecoach driver was like, oh, yeah, I gave them directions. sorry about that. And so it was really interesting. And so there have been some local historians that have put together a map of how the James brothers escaped the Northfield Bank robbery. And so it fits the timeline. They fit the description. We had a first person account. This feels like real history here. This is fascinating to think again that we were on the map for the James brothers as they're fleeing one of the most famous bank robberies that people still talk about today.
How did it form into a podcast? When did that start taking shape for you?
I think it was just because I was listening to podcasts, and I really liked history podcasts, and there just wasn't anything about local history. And for me, I was interested in Sioux Falls history, and so I found a couple things here and there, and so I started to listen to those, and I'm just like, but what if you're not a really smart person? Like, because I feel like I'm just a girl that likes history, and I think it's interesting. And so I feel like my podcast is super accessible. You don't have to know anything about history. You don't have to have even read the historical marker. I'll read it for you, and then I look into it, and then I think of it more as like a conversation starter. Now, if you're super smart and you listen, you might have way more to say on the topic, way more thoughts and opinions. And I'm just kind of presenting what I found.
Yeah, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Because we're discovering with you the passion and the love that you have for this.
Oh, thanks.
And then you hit the road and go to some towns wherever you're headed.
Yeah.
You'll want to find the local history when you're there. What do you look for when you come to a new town in South Dakota, especially?
Oh, it's one of my favorite things to do on a Saturday is to go to a town that I haven't walked around yet. So I love to park and the main street or whatever that may look like, and then walk it. I like to walk the populated area, the oldest area. I like to look for the oldest buildings. I like to just kind of figure out if they have any historical markers and plaques on my own. If I don't find anything that way, I do look online. And then after that, I usually hit up the cemetery because that's where a lot of our history lies as well.
Yeah. Where else do you want to walk?
Yeah, there's one that's right over there about the hanging of an innocent man.
Let's go there.
The hanging of an innocent man, sort of near where the gallows were, where this guy ends up getting hung for a crime that he did not commit. He is definitely guilty, but in the court of public opinion, which was enough at the time. You know, you have a lot of people saying that you're a bad husband. Well, a bad husband and a murderer are two different things. So this guy, he gets killed for the murder of his wife, which was actually her daughter. Catherine Van Horn gets to live 45 years of her life with that on her mind, knowing that she had let her stepfather hang for a crime that he didn't commit.
It's a graphic story here.
It is.
Just sitting in front of the old courthouse of him, they have to make an attempt to end his life three times.
It's shocking. Whenever I see people read this one, I get kind of excited because the front of the historical marker lures you in, and then the back of it is horrific. It's like, oh my gosh, it's just you can't undo it. It's what happened. It's like, I believe the second legal hanging that happens in Dakota Territory, the first one being Jack McCall, the guy that killed Wild Bill. So yeah, this is the second one, and it's in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Again, we're making the map for just fascinating pieces of history here.
So Catherine confesses on her deathbed and therefore clears her stepfather's name 45 years later.
You know, a priest told me once that deathbed confessions are great unless you get hit by a bus. So, I mean, we're lucky, I guess, that she had a deathbed to confess on, but it's still such...
Or she had a conscience?
Her Jiminy Cricket was real small. Like, he was... I don't know. Like, I guess I'm glad that at the end she said something, but I feel like before he got hung was a better time. So,
how will the history of this town, of your town, be remembered now? Do you think about that?
I do. And local history is everywhere. You know, just wherever you are, that's local history. And I feel like I'm hoping with the podcast that I am just starting a conversation. Local history should be discussed like when you're at the bar with your friends, or when you're having brunch with your mom, or when you're out with the community. I think it's a great time to bring up pieces of local history, especially legend and lore and oral histories. And I love some hot history goss. So, like, you know, just all of these things that might not even be accurate, but like, let's talk about it. And where did you hear that? And what do you think about that? And how can we research it? Is there a way to figure out if that's true or not? How did it make it on the historical marker?
Yeah. Is there a piece of your personal family history that you're like, I wish that was a marker somewhere?
I will say that my mom is super into genealogy. And so we have found things. We have found the skeletons. We have danced with them. We have taken them to dinner. They're out of the closet. And it's so fun because honestly, unless it's my parents, I could care less. I think it's great hearing about all of these awful things that happened in the family tree. I think we found one where it was somebody related by marriage, so we could definitely have a good laugh about it, but these kids totally killed their dad. And it's like, this is awful. Like, they chased him down a hill, buried him in a well, and I'm just like, oh, family. Like, we had a good laugh about it.
That's Local Lou of the Local Lou podcast. We took a walk together through downtown Sioux Falls to explore our history through the lens of a few local markers. Now, Craig Howe also introduces people to local history. He runs the Center for American Indian Research and Native Studies, or CAIRNS. You've heard him often on this show, and since 2007, he has offered traveling history seminars through Lakota lands. He focuses on viewing monuments and markers through a critical academic lens, and it will change the way you think about history. That lens starts with the landscape on which we tell our narratives about the past.
We'd be riding horses around, and a dad would be telling stories about something that went on there. And so as we went around the land, it becomes this meaningful place where you're connecting with ancestors or relatives. And it just grew up that way. And I didn't really hit until later, like in college, I think, where the importance of narrative. Learning facts is important. There's no doubt about that. But narratives are what's going to engage us, and those are what's going to share these stories that most of us want to know about our relatives or ancestors. So I'd say that's where it started.
How important, looking back, for you then was being physically in the space?
I think it's important. I mean, that's what would trigger dad's stories or someone else's, grandpa's stories, anyone's stories, is when we're someplace doing something. Then they, you know, they remember this and they share that. And at some level, it's critical. So on that narrative level, I think it's almost critical. On the importance of place, now that's something a little different. We can't guarantee someone's going to feel something when they go someplace. But what we always say is, if we don't go there, you don't even have a chance. You know, we could sit in a classroom, we could do it on Zoom, we could do it any other way. We can convey all the exact same information. But if you aren't there, if there is something called power of place or the land has power, if that exists, and we're not going to argue either way, I mean, we have our personal opinions, but then we have to be there. You have to be there. And then you have to open yourself up. You gotta, you know, be prepared or be open, and then it might happen and it might not.
Tell me about the traveling seminars. How are they structured?
The first thing we tell everyone, even in the preliminary stuff, just to try to get it in their mind, this isn't a tour and you're not a tourist. For most of these, you can get college credits. I mean, we have to do the work, the paperwork ahead of time, but on the 5-day ones, I can get 3 credit hours. There are ways to reinforce this idea that it's an academic course.
Yeah.
But otherwise, what we do is when you get in motion, usually one of the very first things we do is an assessment just so that we have a baseline. And it's always really good because we always have people who think they're knowledgeable, and rightfully so, they might be. But our assessment that we've given, it's around 6,000 times now. The average score is 19 out of 100. We've given it to, you know, school educators. We've given it to middle school students. We've given it to PhDs. We've given it to American Indians, non-Indians. It just doesn't matter. It's really uniform. If you take, I think what we say is 16 plus or minus 3, you're going to get the standard deviation. You'll get almost everyone in that score. So everyone's on board that, oh, we don't know. And then we can start. And we start them working together right away. So in 2 seats, they're a team for less than an hour. And we switch everyone. We try to switch 9 times a day, random. It's systematic because what we want is by the end of the 5 days, if we have 48 people and we have 5 days, you're going to sit in every seat on the bus and you're going to sit with someone different every time. And that's the goal also. And you have this educational goal. You also have this networking or personal goal of everyone meeting and interacting with each other.
What is the assessment looking for? Knowledge about what?
All of our seminars deal with American Indians. So we have 2 assessments. One is Ocheti Shakowin, history and culture.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is Lakotan history and culture. So if we're strictly dealing with Lakotan topics, we might use that one. But even when we're doing Lakotan, they being Lakotans, are part of this Ocheti Shakowin Confederacy. And so that's our standard assessment because no one's ever developed this. Anyone can call themselves an expert, but there's no, you know, like a praxis exam. So we can say, okay, this person is knowledgeable. They aren't just claiming it, but we can demonstrate that. And it's graded for 9th grade. Students and 9th grade students in the Sioux Falls School District in the Native American Connections, their teacher, of course, is bragging on them, but they usually can ace that, not 100%, but they'll get within 90% of scores. After they've gone through all their courses, right? Not the very first time, they'll fail it just like everyone else.
What happens on site and how do people open themselves up to whatever their experience on a challenging historic location when they're standing there might be?
And so it depends on what site we're at. So like if we're going to Wounded Knee, that's one of those sites that we really try to give them time.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just so emotional. So in those cases, we give them exercises and we have color pencils and all these type of little kits they can take with them and record. And we give them suggestions of what you might want to do, but they don't have to. It's not being forced, but it gives them permission to draw, right? And it's not, they don't have to turn it in. It's for themselves. We keep reinforcing this. These are things you are recording and you'll keep it. And 10 years from now or 10 days from now, you might want to go back and look at it again. So in those cases, you're trying to minimize external influences and give them time and space, or I don't know how to say that, but so that they can be independent or sole bodies out there in the landscape. In the other places, we want them to be critical thinkers. And so we're asking them to look for content at the panels that are in the national or the state parks, right? So they're reading. Even, you know, the font size, location of font, past tense, present tense, all this type of information. But we're asking them detailed questions that they have to find that information. Then we have, you know, these debrief periods either on the bus or in groups, and they can discuss what they've seen or what they're feeling.
How do you critically look at something that's been placed before you and think about it in new ways and be open to that?
First of all, you're just looking for presence, absence. So here's a panel about the history of Wind Cave. Does it mention American Indians? You know, and that's the first thing. So you're just looking and you're just trying to find something. So then, does it mention American Indians? Does it mention Lakotans? And then you want to see, is it using the plural or the singular? Is it written where these people are, that they're mentioning are active and have efficacy, or are they being acted upon and passive? Is it in the past tense? Is it in the present tense? And the kind of the graphic design is, you know, is it high on a panel or low on a panel, big or little font? Is it, you know, a lot of things with American Indians, they want to use a font like papyrus, something that looks rugged or rural or, you know, kind of old, something like that. You know, what I always say is you hardly ever see American Indian logos that use Helvetica or Arial font, right? Those are too sophisticated for Indians, right? So people start to think graphic design, grammar, just presence or absence, and all of these. And we give them a little sheet, a guide, so that they can know what to look for. You know, for a long time at Wind Cave, to pick on them a little bit, but, you know, they said the only mention of American Indians was that they appeared in the park in 1937. This is just
the absurdity of that. The absurdity of that.
And if we say it, that's one thing. But when they're there looking for it, and they come back and you have 48 people and they can't find anything but that, then you're like, well, see, it's not just me. This is a fact. And that's what we really try to stress all the way through everything we do, is that it's evidence-based. So we have our personal opinions, and like when I'm on the bus, I'll share personal opinions, but I try to make it clear, this is a personal opinion, but all the rest will be evidence that you can look up or ask us. We even carry a traveling library with us when we're on the bus. So if someone asks a question our team doesn't know, then we get out the reference books and we'll find the answer and get it for them.
How do people respond to the experience? What are some of the things that you've seen from the people who are moved or really transformed by traveling in this way?
It's really positive. And we usually go to Wind Cave right from the very first day. So we're there by 10 o'clock or leaving by 10:30, I think. So they've only been on the bus a couple hours. So many of them will say, I've learned more this morning than I've learned so far in any class. And we also know that from the assessment, that we aren't giving people either structurally in schools or even outside of school these opportunities to learn. And we always have people that want to get on the bus. How do I get on the bus? You know, they want on the bus because they've heard about it.
Mostly for organizations, groups that are traveling together, like teachers from the same school, business people from the same company, or are there opportunities for single, you know, people who want to fund their own trip to get on the bus?
Up until now, and we've explored this, but we just don't have the staff to do one ourselves, where we just open it up to everyone. But so far, a client or customer will contract with us to offer one of these. Mm-hmm. And like it was a school district or Monument Health and even Regional Health before them, Arts South Dakota, different organizations for different lengths of time. And then they fill the bus as they want. Mm-hmm. But some of these have been with executives from all organizations, maybe not all across the United States, but as far as Georgia and as far maybe as Montana, that distance, and Texas to North Dakota.
What do you hope that somebody, especially coming from out of state, who is going back to their own state, say they're going back to Georgia, and now they're looking at their own historic markers, which would be very different from ours, and they're asking some of those critical questions about their own history with new eyes, what do you hope happens next after they've come through your traveling seminars?
As representing Cairns, we would hope they're developing their critical thinking facilities. So it's not so much to learn a specific topic, but just how to think, you know, and here's some clues on how to think and how to explore through geometry and drawing and these different ways that just these help you look and observe critically or closely. Most of us, we see everything. We got eyes and we're looking around and we don't record it. We don't have it down good. And so these cause you to slow down, look, record. And I think that's what we would hope more so than the actual content. Closely tied would be this idea. Yeah, there is a one viewpoint someplace. There are these other viewpoints. And we want them to make the decision. We don't want to make that decision for them. We just want them to see that in most of these major events, we have multiple viewpoints. And someone, a historian in the past or present, they have told us which is the truth or the right one. And we challenge that a lot of times. But we don't want to say we're the ones now that are telling the truth.
Is there something about the human condition or the Western academic viewpoint that tries to consolidate things down to a plaque that can be explained in 300 words? What is it about us that wants to tell a story but tells it in such a limited way? Yeah, what does that bring up? I have my own ideas about why we're doing that, but what do you think?
I don't think a lot of these these historical site placards or those, I'm not sure how academic those are.
Okay, yeah.
But they are kind of like PR for the state usually, or for the government, some organization, and rarely are those organizations trying to paint a full picture. So you'll get a viewpoint that, you know, uses battle rather than massacre, just to use a real simple example. We'll mention, you know, all these things, but not the other peoples that are here. Or what's the status of this land? You know, how did this land become so that someone can live here that isn't even from here? And we see, again, just information and true information of the process of settling this land, of, say, immigrants, how Vine Delore used to say immigrants, meaning people not from right here. These immigrants that come, they bring their perspective, and usually they want to paint their ancestors, as I think almost all of us do. We want to paint our ancestors out as basically good people.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Now, South Dakota's oldest buildings are reaching a tipping point. In the current issue of South Dakota Magazine, editor Bernie Hunhoff travels the state to ask what's worth saving. He visits with architects and historians and concerned citizens about the church's homes and histories worth preserving and the ones that might be ready to release into decay.
Some of our oldest architecture is now 100, 125 years old. And a lot of it really is at a tipping point, and we have to decide as a people, you know, is this important to us, as it is in European countries especially? Is this important to us? Is this something that's worth saving?
Yeah.
Because we're seeing a lot of these old buildings really, again, at a tipping point.
So the buildings that were built by the newcomers, by the immigrants, by the Germans, the Norwegians, the Czechs, the people who came into this place where there was already centuries of life and culture, that's the tipping point we're talking about.
Yeah, and they were an optimistic, progressive bunch of folks who even the smallest towns built in many cases some really grand buildings, and it just showed that their optimism for the future, and they thought that this community was going to be important, you know, for generations and generations to come. So they had a vision of what those places would be, and a lot of times that vision came from their European roots, where they wanted little downtown villages where everybody could walk from home to the stores and to the church and the schools, and everything was clustered downtown, oftentimes with a plaza. So they had a European vision in many cases, and now we're left with that, and we're left to decide whether that's still important, worth saving.
Yeah. You asked the question, what is worth saving in different towns across the state? What are some of the answers that you got? Who did you ask for the big picture and the commonalities of that question?
First of all, reached out to some of the architects that we really respect. And then along with that, city officials, historians, you know, folks like that who are really engaged in preservation and community building.
What are some of the answers that they said? Not every old building is a good building. Some of them just weren't made to last.
Well, they weren't made to last sometimes, and a lot of those are probably gone already.
Yeah.
Or they were built in a place where it just isn't feasible today. I think of Dolan, a great little community of Dolan, where there's a wonderful old brick building that Hubert Humphrey's family ran a drugstore out of, you know, in the 19-teens and 20s. And Hubert Humphrey worked in that drugstore. From the outside, yet the four brick walls are looking pretty good. If that building was in downtown Sioux Falls or downtown Rapid City or maybe even Yankton and Aberdeen, it would be a treasure. And architects and community leaders would probably be fighting over who gets to be in that building. But it sits in Dolan, South Dakota, where there just hasn't been a need for it. So in a lot of cases, the buildings are just in the wrong place at the wrong time, you might say.
How important is it who owns it and what their vision is for it?
Interesting issue there, very important. In some cases, the people who own it are people who really care about the building or bought it for all the right purposes, but they just didn't have the resources or the know-how to really keep it up. You see that in the article of buildings where oftentimes an out-of-state person comes through here with some means, and they find out that they can buy a building in South Dakota on Main Street, a brick building, a historical building, for maybe, I don't know, $50,000 or $100,000, and they think, wow, you know, where I come from, that'd be $1 million.
Right.
So they buy it, but they don't realize, you know, that it's going to be really hard to fix that up in South Dakota and find an occupant that'll pay a high enough rent to pay for their repairs. The dollars and cents just don't work. They don't have the ability, and maybe they don't even have the resources to really carry it to the next level. That's a common problem, actually.
Yeah.
In other cases, people buy these old buildings in some of the towns surrounding Sioux Falls. I'm told, you know, people maybe from the Sioux Falls area or other cities will buy an old building just because it's cheap storage, and they just want cheap storage, and they don't really care if the roof leaks a little bit or the windows fall out or things like that. It's really used in a really, underused, I guess,
sure,
you might say. Maintenance and repairs and what it needs to be, and the buildings just slowly deteriorate. So, yeah, the owner of the building, the ownership, and the purpose is really important.
So let's talk about, you've got some experience with this. You've picked up some things and saved them from the bulldozer yourself, I understand. Yeah, tell me what got into your head.
Really out of necessity, you know, and we started the magazine in 1985, and we had no readers, so that means we had no money, and we had a young family, and I did have a little patch of land, so yeah, I bought a house for $1,500 from a guy who wanted it off his cornfield. It had been empty for a few years. I bought an old house, and we moved it to our farm and fixed it up, so that was our first. Then we had a neighbor who said, you want to move my barn? He had a barn he didn't want, and we moved that over there. And then in 1987, when the magazine was just getting going, we bought an old building in Yankton. We didn't even know it at the time. It was a territorial governor's home. Yankton had about, I don't know, 7 or 8 territorial governors. They all built homes, but they didn't build them to South Dakota standards with Dakota Territory standards at that time, with foundations that would withstand the frost-free cycle.
Yeah.
So they all collapsed fairly soon. In our case, the governor, Pennington, met a builder at the train station from Montreal who told him, if you're going to build a house, you need these big stone foundations. So he did build it properly, and we were able to buy that for, I think, like $10,000 from a guy who had a bulldozer and was going to bulldoze it in 1987. And it's been a great office for us ever since. Our staff of 10 people working that today have worked in it for almost 40 years.
Wow, that's fantastic. Let's talk about some of the buildings that you highlight in South Dakota Magazine, this issue, that are either in trouble or are in good hands. Where do you want to begin?
We found about a dozen or more that are really in trouble, and they range everything from, you know, just a neat old, well, it's not a neat old house today, it's a really dilapidated house in the little town of Blount, just east of Pierre. I followed that house all the 40 years we've published South Dakota Magazine. That's kind of the case for a lot of these. We've seen them rise and fall. When we first started the magazine, a sweet little lady was living in that house for the town, and taking care of it as a little museum. It's the Mentor Graham House. Mentor Graham was a teacher of Abraham Lincoln. So its only claim to fame really is not architectural, but historical. It belonged to probably the most influential teacher of Abraham Lincoln.
Wow.
At one time, the community of Blount put some resources into it, kept it up, found a lady to live there and be the curator. And then eventually, of course, she moved on, and the house was closed, and then a big flood did some damage to it, and one thing led to another, and now it looks like it's probably not going to be here for long.
Oh.
So some of these we've seen come and go, at times in our history of our magazine, even they were in pretty good shape,
yeah.
And now they're probably going to be lost within the year or so.
Yeah. That reminds me of the story where Tamara St. John is trying to figure out how to save even a feature inside a mural. Mm-hmm. What can be saved from the building if the building isn't recoverable or salvageable? Can you save some of the elements from it is also what you're seeing.
That becomes part of the discussion. I think in every case in the buildings that we profile in this article, you're talking about the Carnegie Library in Sisseton, where there's, a mural by Paul Warcloud, who was one of the most noted artists from the Sisseton-Wahpeton tribe in northeast South Dakota. And there's a beautiful mural in that Carnegie Library that she hopes to save. But in almost every case, there are people in the community who really think, those buildings should be saved, but some of them have just deteriorated too far in many cases. Sometimes they're just in the wrong ownership hands. In fact, the article starts out a story from Brad Burns. He's an architect in Rapid City who said he wanted to save a historical school in his hometown of Philip, and he was going to turn it into housing for the community. And the school district, in his case, they wanted to tear it down and build a parking lot, is what they did. So they wouldn't sell it to him. and they eventually did tear it down. They never did build a parking lot. Just a lost opportunity, it would seem, for everybody.
Yeah.
So oftentimes, everybody's well-intentioned. It just gets complicated who owns it or where it's at and for whatever reason.
This convent in Zell is a good example of somebody who had a very big, grand idea that looks quite European. Tell me about that one.
You can just see it looks like a building out of Switzerland, right?
Yeah.
And these Benedictine nuns came from Switzerland, I believe, and located in the small community of Zell, which is west of Redfield. And the convent building that they built is still standing there in reasonably good shape. It's been closed since 1963 as a convent.
Okay.
So I can't do the quick math, but that's like 50, 60 years or more, 60 years. It's still in pretty darn good shape because there's always been somebody who just kind of kept shingles on the roof. In this case, a wood building. They always kept some shingles on it, some paint on it. And it's not in terrible shape. It looks like it could still be used. But this community of Zell is probably a population of about a dozen people, and there's just really no practical use for it.
Yeah. You write a beautiful piece about the penitentiary in Sioux Falls. As we talk about a new prison, I don't know that I've heard anybody quite as eloquently say what happens to the old prison and the complexities of that. This is a building that's functioning now, but we see into the future prime real estate. Everybody's going to want to develop that, mm-hmm, and yet mm-hmm. there is this historic building with a really complicated history.
Yeah, an architecturally rich, rich building with a very complicated history. I mean, in some cases, at least a school, we touch on this in the article, at least with a school, there are alumni or teachers or people who say, man, we should save that. I have fond memories of that place. In this case, the alumni do not have fond memories of the place, and it really maybe has no constituency. And yet, it's an important architectural piece of our state. And I hope that at least some attention is given to whether that could be preserved. It's been done in other states. I think we found in 8 or 10 other states where they have been able to preserve a castle-like prison like we have up here. And those quartzite walls, of course, that's a unique architecture to Sioux Falls, really signature construction for Sioux Falls. I'm sure hoping we can have that conversation. I guess it'll depend who the governor is at that time and who the legislators are. But it's I think an opportunity that those buildings and those quartzite walls and some of those core historic buildings could stand there forever and ever if you can just find a practical use for them.
Yeah.
Our communities and our people do support historic preservation. They do see the importance of historic architecture. They know that it gives them a sense of place. It's why our communities are different than other communities.
Yeah.
So I think the community interest is there. What we lack in South Dakota are the incentives that other places have, especially in Europe, where I think the government actually pays for the preservation of some of the old historic churches. That would be unheard of in America, especially in South Dakota. But yet we need to have some kind of incentives where it makes sense for people to invest in historic properties and maintain them properly. Not only do we not have many incentives, we actually have disincentives. Most of our programs are actually geared toward urban sprawl for big construction projects on the outskirts of town. And so we actually have disincentives rather than incentives. Yeah, hopefully our policymakers will look for some ways. Some of our communities, Yankton has facade grants. We do have some we have the Deadwood Preservation Grants now, which are wonderful. So we have some small programs. We need a lot more like that if we're really going to be serious about saving our historic architecture.
You can read Bernie Hunhoff's piece, What's Worth Saving, in the current issue of South Dakota Magazine. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you from all of us at SDPB. We thank you for listening.